Accession number 14983, Albert Shippen, reel 11.
Mr. A. Shippen, reel 11. You wanted to add something to your experiences and recording of those experiences for the time that you were with the boys' service in the training centre, Mr. Shippen. What was it?
Well, apart from the education side of it as a boy in this kind of thing, which we did extensively, we also had religious education. And we used to attend what was commonly known in those days as the Padre's Hour. And the Padre at the time used to tell us about a chap called Cornelius, who he used to say to us was equivalent to a company sergeant major. And his words you can still remember were, he was upright, righteous, God-fearing, man, like our sergeant major, but says, I don't believe that bit, even if he was a padre. But eventually, we joined the class for confirmation as boys, along with other members of the permanent staff and the women's auxiliary service girls, who were also at the unit at that time, the 4th IDC. And that just goes to show that all aspects of life was involved around the training centre, apart from the military side of it.
So the training and education that the regiment was giving boys was basically what you used to say, the good parent. You'd expect from a good parent.
Oh yes, I think that comes out later in your life as you go through life. A lot of the things which you learned under those circumstances did stand you in good stead later on in life.
We got to where you had gone into hospital during your parachutist time and come out and put on the wire list. What happened next?
Well, I got sent back to a holding unit at the 10th Duke of Wellington Battalion in Felton in Northumberland, which was connected with the 4th IDC at the time. They were very anxious to hold on to us up there owing to being a bugler. But like everything else, on the grapevine, it percolated very quickly down to our regimental HQ, at Brantford Castle, that they were holding us there, and within a very short space of time, we had to pack my kit again and get down to Brantford rather quickly, because they were short of experienced buglers, and in particular, people that knew the bugle marches to go out with the band. People could be trained within 3 months or thereabouts on the bugle calls, but to learn the band parts and know the music and when to come in and this kind of musical side of the bugler's job and that, it took quite a long time for you to learn and to practice with the band.
What date was this?
Well, this would be, it was just after D-Day, actually. And of course, you could just imagine that just after D-Day, even training units and that were being scrutinised for who they were holding, and particularly people that was fit and knowledgeable and this kind of thing, as the army needed to be reinforced in Northwest Europe. So they didn't want people who were fit and could go into combat sitting at Brantford doing some particular job when there was younger people like us sitting at Felton doing nothing but twiddling our thumbs.
Did you, or were you able to see the kind of recruits that were coming in increasingly after D-Day and towards the end of the war? Was there any fall-off in standards?
Well, I would think that at that stage, like every army, they were down to rock bottom on manpower and particularly trained people. Because not only, I mean, we were dealing with the infantry side, but if you look at the other side, at the army as a whole, and remember we were in, to that stage, what they call the GSC idiom, where people were being progressed through Brandsmith to go into all arms of the army. I mean, tank crews were required and glider pilots and all this kind of thing, training people to go out and do the job. I remember at one stage we had some very special people brought into the unit, I would think on an experimental stage, and these were people who were backward in education qualifications and also physically. Now, the majority of squads were broke down into having three NCOs with 12 men in what's commonly known as a section. But these platoons had an NCO to every three men. Some of the men were very small and had difficulty in handling weapons and even sloping arms with the rifles or carrying brain guns for any particular time. And also, they had to, in the learning capacity, were very backward. And I think they were trying to find out where, what standard of qualification that these men had to have to become even proficient infantrymen, where they would probably, and I don't say this derogatory, because all arms have a special thing to play. But if you're talking about putting them into even pioneer units, the physical condition of these men handling ammunition, and which was a lot of the work that these people did, there wasn't even places for them. So I think at the end of the day, the majority of these people were discharged because the service was no longer required in any unit in the army that could be found for them.
How long were you with the holding unit?
At Felton. Oh, about 6 to 8 weeks at the most. Once that, as I say, the two units, Brandsmith and Felton, were connected because once you'd done your training in Brandsmith, you went to it. That someone appeared on the scene and said, I'd just seen shipping up at Felton bugling. That would come back down to RHQ quite quickly. And there'd be a letter probably sent off saying, well, he's a regular soldier, enlisted in the Damright Infantry for 9 years and three with the colours. So we were claiming him back. I think it was quite rapid. Although, I must say at that time, being down in Brandsmith doing all my boy service, which was 3.5 years, and this kind of thing, I was looking for a bit more adventurous activity in the army as I was going to be a regular soldier, and to consider that my service, my 9 years with the colours, didn't start till I was 18, and I was just in the 18 year area then.
So what were you doing at Brandsmith when you rejoined the holding?
Oh well, once again I was back down to bugling in the guard room and all this kind of stuff and whatever. But because we were 18 and we'd done our military training, we did have to conform to all military practices in there. And we did our rifle ranges, we did our PE, passed our PE tests. We also had to conform to everything, do night guards when required, and we were armed. We did aircraft recognition, mine identification, and at that period, quite a lot of the training was being switched from the Northwest Europe syndrome to the Far East syndrome, and bringing in Japanese weapons and Japanese mines and what they call the Pongo pits, which the Japanese dug, then put sharp bamboo into it, and then rubbed rotten meat and that into it. So with you with your jungle boots on, went into one of these pits. This pit penetrated your, the sole of your shoe and everything. Boy, knew where you are. You had a poisonous foot. So all those kind of things start to develop around that area as they saw that the Northwest Europe campaign was going to come to an end, and the big switch was going to go to the Far East.
Who was commanding the unit?
It was a lieutenant colonel called Huey McBain. He had commanded the Young Soldiers Battalion at Newton Aycliffe for a time, and he was there. But we had a mixture of officers at staff level in the training wing. That was the 4th ITC of Duke of Wellington's regiments, and of course the usual Peer Corps and RASC, also the Army Catering Corps, and staff officers for the personal selection, which belonged to all and sundry. I remember we had tank captains there from 1721st Lancers and so forth, like that. The regimental headquarters, which was a different organisation altogether, were purely Durham Light Infantry.
Were you living in the castle or on in the grounds?
Oh no, we lived actually at this time, because of the Northwest Europe and that being taken part, a lot of people were being wirelisted and sent back, and then sent back to units, and units were being reformed because it took heavy casualties in battles and this kind of thing, and they were being reformed. We actually, the band and Bugles, lived in the village hall in quite salubrious accommodation. And of course, there was no booking in, there was no guard room, so we more or less had a free hand and a very pleasant stay there for about 6 months in the village hall.
You mentioned that many men were coming in wirelisted, wounded, possibly then going back out again. Did this make the running of the unit difficult, this constant moving in and out? You'd be getting men there who were quite experienced and had seen a lot of warfare, and well, as against other young people like yourself that hadn't seen any at all.
Oh yes, well, I mean, these people coming through on the wireless and this kind of thing, I mean, there was people that had served in the desert and then gone through Sicily and Italy, and particularly 151 Brigade, and I mean, there were such people that coming through a chap I remember particularly who was a major, and he was called Wingy Jackson, who was a solicitor in the Spennymoor and Durham area, and he only had one arm, and these people were still on the active list. The majority of these people as well were identified very prominently because they refused to take their insignias down, and in the case of the 6th Battalion also, they had the black badges and so forth and that. And of course, people that served in different divisions were quite proud of the fact that they'd been in 151 Brigade and the Tyne and Tees, 50 Div, that these were identified very, very quickly. And of course, they were held in a section of the camp which was apart from the training areas. But down in the castle, where it was the Durham Light Infantry mostly, these men mostly came down to regimental headquarters in the castle during the day and were separated from the training unit.
In your experience of these men coming in, was there any reluctance on their part to be going back into action yet again? Have they reached that point in their experience?
Well, it put me hand on my heart, and I can't remember ever meeting anybody that took that attitude, and I think the majority of them were very keen to get out of a training unit, because you must remember that although they were in a special section of the camp, they still had to conform to the book and in and out. And of course you can appreciate that these men standing to attention to an NCO was a far distant past relic in their minds. And of course the other side of it, the recruits, if you spoke to them and you were would stand to attention to anybody and salute anybody, well, these other chaps were just the opposite. And of course they had known each other and lived through difficult times together, and they had the comradeship, and knew how they relied on each other in battle and that, and were a different breed altogether. And I think the NCOs of the training wing accepted that, in fact, and didn't look towards this obedience without questions and that. And I think there was quite a bit relaxation on the discipline side also in their section of the camp. But I must say, it never reflected on the other part where they were training these people to obey the orders without question.
What happened to you next?
Well, after many trials and tribulations, and probably to put it in better words, making a nuisance of myself, I went on the interview and said I'd been a boy soldier and I'd been in the band and bugles all this time now. And it was time, now I was coming up to the age of 18 and a half, I would like to go off to join a regular battalion. This request was turned down about probably three or four times due to the circumstances that we were still going out doing these parades, Wings for Victory, Salute the Soldier, and so forth and that. And also the band had been sent to Northwest Europe as a morale builder to go around playing to the troops and that in Northwest Europe, which meant that the buglers at the depot and for other activities, playing at the assizes, would you believe, we used to go down play a fanfare when the judge came in at the assizes. We also used to go to places like Newcastle Central Hall and that to play fanfares and people's funerals and all this. Had plenty of activity in that line, even for buglers, and requests from organisations to go, even remembrance parades and other functions that the organisations did, playing at football matches and that. We were very hard pressed. It may sound stupid saying so, but we had a full calendar week in and week out under those circumstances. Anyway, I went off to eventually. I got a posting to the 1st Battalion, who were then stationed in Greece, in which is called Northern Macedonia. Where, after trials and tribulations, we went down by train to Dover, crossed across the channel, obviously by ferry, got on a train at Calais, and was shot across France in this train, which took about 36 hours or something, down to Toulon. And when we were at Toulon, we then were boarded a troop ship, which took us across to Port Said. And when we got to Port Said, because we were going to Greece and there wasn't a lot of troop ships going that way or naval craft at that time, we shot down to what they call the GBD Cairo, outside Cairo Ismailia, in this huge transit camp. We started off with about 350 people en route to go to Greece. And each morning we paraded, this detachment dwindled at a very fast rate of knots, till I think there was something about 12 of us for the Durham Light Infantry, and we were all regulars, and we'd stood our grounds that we wanted to go to our unit. Otherwise, at one period of time, I was called out by the sergeant major in this company we were being held at, and I was told I was going on a dog handling course. So we eventually ended up, I ended up with the battalion in Exante, and we were up there for about...
Can I ask the date that this happened?
Well, this would be now about the back end of 45, beginning of 46.
Just before I go further, the war had ended.
Yes, yes.
What are your recollections of that event and what you were doing at that time?
Well, I more or less covered a lot of that because we had all these activities going on. And one of the things I remember in particular, we were, me and another bugler, were sent to Newcastle City Civic Centre to do Victory in Europe gala. And I can't remember the name of the choir involved, but I remember distinctly that they sang Handel's Be Not Afraid. And then we were to come in and play Last Post and Long Reveille. I don't know about Handel being not afraid, but it frightened the living daylights out of me, this choir singing thing, Handel being not afraid. And then they expected two of us to burst into the life sounding these calls. It was a very nerve-wracking position to be in, that kind of business.
How did you feel that the war ended? Did you feel that you'd missed something, you wanted to get into it, or were you relieved that you weren't going to have to get into it?
Well, I think, to be absolutely truthful, after you'd seen all the experience of these people in the training units and people in old units coming back and forwards and this kind of thing, you looked at the war with a kind of insight that, okay, it had to be done, but by God, what a hell of a price some people paid individually, as well as what the nation had paid in for it in its trials and tribulations. But I think that everybody was quite relieved that it was all that the war had ended in all aspects of it. Because the tragedy of it all was, again, as the war did finish and people started to come back from the various units which had been on ERE and attached to this and done that and all that, and heading for DMOB under the process of having a group number. You got a group number for how many years you'd been in, how many overseas tours you'd done and this kind of thing, and people coming back. I think a lot of regular soldiers even had their minds changed by war and came out. And I think this is where the army really felt the draft, because they thought a lot of regular soldiers would continue on, but they didn't. And quite a lot took the demob at the time and didn't re-enlist into the situation. But there again, as after a year or something like that, quite a considerable amount of them then re-enlisted because they just didn't find that civilian life was for them. They wanted to combat the army. The tragic thing about it all was that units had been obviously the existence of the service had took people out into all sorts of spheres and different departments in the army and this kind of thing. And when the two battalions, which are the first and second in as far as the Dunmore were concerned, turned around and were looking for the regular soldiers, they were scattered far and wide. And these people were in HQs and this kind of thing. And as the army decreased and people went out, they couldn't afford to send you back to your particular parent unit because they were running short of people. And when we were in Exante and drafts started to go home on demob and that, our battalion shrunk rapidly from the people that was in on emergency only. And we'd been reinforced by the 16th Battalion members who had at the end of the war had finished up in Austria at a place called Graz, and all those that had a certain amount of service and had to do and regulars and that came from Austria into Greece and stood there with the mouths open after the palatial places had been built in Austria and then marvellous uniforms and that they'd got, to find there was a rag and bobtail of a forgotten British army that was serving in Greece, in Fordiv.
What was the battalion doing in Greece?
Well, it was hard to tell, apart from probably guarding ourselves, but one of the main objects that we did, it was called UNRWA in those days. I think it's called the United Nations now. I think it was the United Nations Rehabilitation Organization or something. And we used to tramp round all of these villages in northern Macedonia, and that which had been occupied by the Germans and that, and hand out these UNRWA relief parcels. The funny thing and the ironic part about it was, by the time we got back to Exante, which wasn't a very big town at all, the parcels were down on sale in the marketplace because they didn't eat the spam and that was in it. It wasn't their menu that was in the parcels, so they flogged the parcels back off for probably garlic and fish, salted fish and all this kind of thing, but they didn't appeal to the spam and anything. We used to do some horse trading with them. We would sell, exchange matches with them and soap and that for fresh eggs and watermelons and so forth and that. But it was a peculiar kind of role. Marcos, General Marcos, he was the communist general. And what they did was the communists used to come across the border from Bulgaria and Albania and Yugoslavia and that in that northern part of Greece, and do what they called an attack, but they never did any particular real damage, more of a nuisance value, and probably thumb the noses at us and then run back through the mountains into these communist countries and say, well, thank you very much for the outing. And that was it.
And did you get involved in any of these actions, these activities?
Oh, well, yeah, we used to go out on patrol with Bren guns and this kind of thing, Bren gun carriers and patrols and what have we. But there was very little real action. It was more or less escape and evasion kind of stuff. But there was never any real battle. I don't think they could... And, of course, the other part of it was, which we didn't want to get involved with at that time, was the Civil War was going on. Because Churchill had decided to put the King of the Hellenes back on the throne, and of course the communists who had been fighting the Germans throughout the war didn't want him back on the throne, so it was brother against brother, which was quite a brutal, we saw quite a bit of activity as far as they were concerned, the two, the Nationalist Army and the Royalist Army. but we never got involved into it to any great degree. We were there mainly as a stopgap to stop the communists from getting into Greece and taking over control of Greece, I suppose. That would have given them access into the Mediterranean at that time, and we were there doing that kind of duty.
So basically you were watching what was going on, but not getting involved in it.
Yes.
I'm thinking in terms of the Civil War.
Yeah, I mean, the Civil War was at its peak and this kind of, and I mean, the atrocities and all this kind of thing was were going on between the two Greek armies. And we were there, more or less, as a buffer force, but not taking any part in the Civil War, but ensuring that the Yugoslavians and that, or the Bulgarians and Albanians, didn't cross over and support the communists.